Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
People with little else in common can bond over sports teams or a shared love of snorkeling or salsa dancing. Me, I always feel like I found a kindred spirit when somebody confesses they sometimes browse the dictionary for fun. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. There's just so much promise in a dictionary or an encyclopedia or any book that sets out to explain so many things. But where did reference books come from, and what kind of person rises to the challenge of collecting and categorizing so much information? Jack Lynch is professor of English at Rutgers University. His new book is called You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. Jack, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with something most of us probably hadn't considered before. You note that we use the word look in searching for information. We look something up because we invented the technology of writing. Before writing, we associated pursuit of facts with listening.
Well, that's just it. Reference books don't necessarily have to look like books as we expect them. They can be electronic. They can be on clay tablets. But they're necessarily products of the world of writing, because in a world where there is no writing, looking something up makes no sense. You ask someone. You find the person who's got the most in his or her head. But we all live in a culture that's permeated with texts, and that's how we now know where to get our information more than one head can ever hold.
We can get information from just about any book. So what makes a reference book specifically a reference book?
That's a good question. And when I started this project, I was going to tell the history of reference books. I thought, I'm going to need a sentence or two explaining what a reference book is. And then I realized I don't have a simple sentence or two. There's an institutional definition in libraries. Often reference books are the ones that you can't take out of the building. But what we usually mean by reference book is it's something that is designed not to be read from start to finish. Now, of course, we can read anything in whatever chunks we choose, but reference books are structured in a way so that if you have a specific question, you can turn to the piece of information you need and find what it is without going through the rest of it. So the pieces are supposed to make sense on their own.
Another ostensibly simple thing you tried to do was calculate how many might be out there. Why was that so hard to do?
Well, believe it or not, there is no good library catalog that covers everything. The closest we've got is a catalog that is the combined electronic catalogs of hundreds of libraries. So that gets us close to everything we're ever likely to come across. But a great many old books from the 18th, 19th, early 20th century never made it into any catalog. And many of the world's languages are just badly cataloged anywhere. So I came up with a figure that, just by looking at round numbers, gets us at least into the low millions.
Wow.
But, it's probably impossible to be any more precise than that.
So as you mentioned earlier, as we began to accumulate more knowledge as a society than any individual could recall and pass on, that was when we needed this external memory in the form of reference works. Scrolls were a great technology for lots of documents, but it's a lot of rolling and unrolling to find your way to what you need to know.
Yeah, well, the earliest writing technologies we know of are clay tablets and monumental inscriptions, things carved on stone. And they actually have been used as reference works for a while. But for much of the ancient world, when the Greeks, when the Romans, when the ancient Hebrews spoke about books, they meant scrolls. And scrolls are, well, as you think, they're rolls of fabric of some sort. Probably parchment or papyrus. Papyrus is made from plants, parchment made from animal skin. And you can see a little bit of the text in front of you at any time. But if you want to get to about halfway through a scroll, you have to turn both sides of the scroll until you get around to the middle of it. Sometime around the first century of the Common Era, a new technology was invented, and scholars call it a codex. But the rest of us just think of it as a book. Now, as I said, the Greeks and Romans had books, but they meant scrolls. For us, when we've got a bunch of leaves that are bound together on one side and let us flip anywhere in the middle, we call that a codex. And a codex was an important breakthrough in reference technology because you can now jump immediately to page 257. You can have an index in the back of the book and zip right back to the middle. So it's a technological innovation. It's a very old technological innovation, but it's one that made reference, I won't say possible, but a lot easier.
You know, I have taken the codex for granted for my entire life, and I won't do that anymore.
Well, it's true. And people are... Some are celebrating, some are complaining the way that modern technology is changing our old approaches to reference and reading and all of these sorts of things. But technology has always been changing the way we read. So the invention of writing was the first big technological invention related to the word. And then we have the codex and the scroll, and then we have printing with movable type. And now we're just going through another one of these big changes with the computer.
Were there people railing about the loss of, you know, inscribed tablets and scrolls to these codexes, do you think?
We don't have a lot of good evidence about that, but most of the other changes, there have been people complaining about it. And one of the more interesting things that happens after the invention of printing, you'd think once we have this fancy technology of printing and now the handwritten book is thoroughly obsolete, for decades after the invention of printing, people would hire scribes to copy printed books by hand into their own manuscript copies. So we've got our people today who love the feel of old books and so on, that sort of fetishism for the old technology. That's a very old desire.
Among the earliest works of reference were law books, which makes a certain sense, and the Code of Hammurabi is a very notable example.
Yeah, that's the first one I look back on because it's some of the earliest writing we've got that we can date. People who investigate old, very old writing are often a little surprised and maybe a little disappointed. We expect, or at least hope, that the earliest writing we've got will be these brilliant poems and insights into a culture. Actually, most of the earliest writing in every civilization is lists. It's warehouse inventories and tax records and things like that. And when you think about it, it makes sense. This is the stuff that you can't remember and has to be written down. But laws are very often among the first things written down in any culture. And at some point, a society reaches the point where there are a lot of laws. If you've got just, say, 10 commandments, you can memorize them. If you've got, you know, U.S. code and it goes on for many dozens of volumes, then someone has to put it in a place where you can look it up. And the Code of Hammurabi, discovered right at the very beginning of the 20th century, but dating to 1750 B.C., is one of the earliest examples we have of that. It's a collection of Babylonian law put in one place that gathered together laws from many different sources, and now anyone could find what they wanted to see.
Is there reason to believe that there were less comprehensive antecedents to the Hammurabi Code?
Almost certainly. Our evidence from this period is really incomplete. We have only little bits and bobs from ancient Mesopotamia. But the scholars who've looked closely at the Code of Hammurabi say this is almost certainly a compilation of laws that have already existed and circulated. So these weren't new laws. These were someone's collection to put them all in one place. So yeah, we've probably lost, well, we've certainly lost a great deal that predates our references.
How have we made decisions over the course of history about what information goes into reference books and what inevitably has to be left out to make the book manageable?
Yeah, well, I'll anticipate a little bit and say that in the electronic age, we're rethinking all of this. But in the age of print, there is a limit to just how much you can put in a book and consider it profitable. There are some reference books that are vast, that are hundreds of volumes. There's a German encyclopedia from the 19th century that's 242 volumes. There's a library catalog that's thousands of volumes of print. But finding anyone willing to publish these things, willing to do the expense of putting them together, is really tricky. So almost everyone has to find a limit to what goes in the book and what doesn't. Now, there are some things where that answer is settled for you. If you're doing, for instance, a table of numbers, you pick the first number, you pick the last number, and you decide what the interval is in between, and you've got your answer. But for things like dictionaries and encyclopedias, we see the word unabridged, which since Webster in the 19th century has meant nothing taken out. Unabridged dictionaries don't exist. Every dictionary, even the biggest dictionaries, have only a small fraction of what's out there in the real world. And there are teams of people who have to make these decisions. They usually say if it's too obscure, for instance, technical terms in one profession usually don't end up in dictionaries. Scientific and technical terms, they often don't make the cut. Then there's a sense of, a subjective sense of just what's important. Anyone who has ever worked on a reference book at some length has been approached by outsiders volunteering new entries. Anyone who's written dictionaries will get email, sometimes several times a week, from people helpfully volunteering. I have five new words that are perfect for your dictionary. The generous ones offer to give them. The less generous ones offer to sell them to the dictionary makers. And the dictionary makers almost always send back a polite little form letter saying, thank you. That's not the way we do things.
Well, these days, dictionaries are written by committee, but it wasn't that way in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. For instance, the most famous early dictionary in English, a lot of people say the first dictionary, but it's not actually, was by Samuel Johnson. He did a major English dictionary in 1755, and he did it pretty much by himself. In France, a committee of 40 people had worked for 40 years on the French dictionary, and Johnson said he was going to do the same sort of dictionary by himself in three. And people said, that's impossible. And Johnson said, well, let me see. 40 times 40 is 1,600. As 1,600 is to three, such is the ratio of an Englishman to a Frenchman. Even Johnson, though, had a team of people copying things out for him and making notes. But the one-person reference book is now the rarity. The norm is big committees. It's teams of professional lexicographers. The American Heritage Dictionary, one of the great current dictionaries, now in its fifth edition, has 178 named people on the masthead and 21 people who contributed to it and have died before the book came out. So, yeah, nowadays it tends to be a big collaborative effort.
Johnson was this sort of delightfully strange figure. And I guess to do this the first time in such a, you know, take on such a big project, you'd need someone who was obsessive the way he was.
Yeah, Johnson was a mess in all sorts of ways. He was blind in one eye, almost blind in the other, deaf in one ear, almost deaf in the other. He had obsessive compulsive disorder. He was bipolar. He had just about every condition you care to name. But he was a fabulous reader. He read quickly and he retained things in a way virtually no one else could do. And he set himself up alone in an attic, and he said it would be 3 years. He missed it. He spent nine, although he may well have done it in about half that time and then sat on it to spite his publishers.
Still pretty good compared to 1,600 French years. Right?
Exactly.
We're speaking with Jack Lynch. He's professor of English at Rutgers University and author of a new book called You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Professor Jack Lynch of Rutgers University. He teaches English there and is author of a new book called You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jack, when the French wrote that big dictionary by committee, they intended to write not just descriptions of what was believed to be proper French, but rules. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are really two different traditions in dictionaries. And one of them we call prescriptive because it prescribes what people should do. And it is concerned with giving the best form of the language. There's another tradition called descriptive, which doesn't tell you what you should do. It simply describes what people do. And in real life, every dictionary is somewhere between these two. It would be impossible to be entirely one or entirely the other. But in general, the French dictionary tradition has always been much more prescriptive. They've decided certain words are bad words. They should not be in the dictionary. And if you use them, you are wrong. The English tradition, starting with Johnson, has always said, well, if enough people do it, the language doesn't have any existence beyond how it's used by people. So if enough people say something, that's what that we should put in the reference books.
Before modern-style dictionaries, some dictionaries were as simple as lists of different words. Why would anybody have taken down those lists, and why are they so precious to modern scholars?
Yeah, some of the most ancient dictionaries that survive are just lists of words, but they're usually words that are grouped together somehow. So a bunch of names of trees or a bunch of kinds of grain and things like that. And we find these ancient clay tablets that are simply lists of words. And scholars think that these were probably put together by people who were trying to learn another language, which, well, they're all ancient for us now. But the Sumerian language had to be studied by the Assyrians for them, even thousands of years after Sumerian stopped being used. So these were probably vocabulary words that students used to learn groups of ideas, the way, well, at least in my childhood, we used flashcards. I suppose in the high-tech digital age, people aren't using flashcards anymore.
Something on the iPad, yeah.
Yeah, very likely.
So many reference works arrange entries in alphabetical order. Why do we even have alphabetical order? How did A to Z become the standard?
That's a great question. Samuel Johnson's definition of a dictionary says a list of the words of any language in alphabetical order with meanings, and he goes on a bit further. And certainly almost every dictionary we can think of is in alphabetical order. But there haven't always been dictionaries in alphabetical order simply because there hasn't always been an alphabet. The earliest writing systems in ancient Babylon had about 1,000 symbols. So they were a large number even for a professional scribe to memorize. And even if you could memorize them, you couldn't memorize them in any order. And languages like modern Chinese and ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs just had far too many symbols for any one order. The alphabet, as we know, got born about 1500 BC in Phoenicia. And it was adapted from Egyptian symbols. It was adapted, but they started using one symbol for one sound, originally one consonant sound. And they ended up with a list of 20-some, depending on the language. And what's remarkable is that list has stayed pretty much in that order for 3,500 years. So in Hebrew, it's Aleph, Bet, Gimel, A, B, and G. In Hebrew, it's Alpha, Beta, Gamma, A, B, G. C is a complicated history. And there's been a little bit of reshuffling over the last 3,500 years. But for the most part, the alphabet has stayed in remarkably consistent order in a lot of languages for a lot of centuries.
So how do you organize a dictionary in a language like Chinese, which don't typically use an alphabet?
Yeah. Well, in the modern era, Chinese dictionaries tend to be organized either in alphabetical order once you transliterate it from Chinese into Roman characters, so a sort of implied alphabetical order, even though it's not their alphabet, or they're put in order by the number of strokes in the central character in the entry. And I don't read any Chinese, I'm sorry to say, and don't have any insight into how that really works. But I've had friends who've studied Chinese, and it's a lot of head-scratching to figure out, okay, well, if the symbol looks like this, would that be the main stroke? Yeah, but there are ways of classifying them. What languages did before there was any alphabet, though, tended to be putting things in a classification. So we decide to put all of the words related to law in this place and all of the words related to medicine in this place and so on. And there have been all sorts of efforts to make a structure that is perfectly naturally organized. The alphabet has a lot of advantages, and sometimes it keeps related words close together. So cat and catty and so on. Words related to cat are fairly close in the dictionary, but words like kitten and feline are very far apart. Hmm. And then we've got words like casuistry and catapult, which are right in with the cats. And some people have looked at that and said, that just doesn't feel right. A properly organized system of all knowledge in the world should have all the like things close to each other. And one of the last great attempts to do that was Peter Marc Roget, famous for Roget's Thesaurus. He was going to do his book without any alphabetical index whatsoever. He thought the whole structure would be perfectly obvious. He would divide it into nouns and adjectives and verbs, and then he would have nouns of physical things and nouns of abstractions, and he'd break it down. You get down to tools. And he thought that his system would be so obvious that any intelligent person could just zip through the list and find exactly what he or she was looking for.
And what happened?
He gave up. Well, he did his system, but he gave up on making that the only way to find information before he'd even finished the book. His son said, no, 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 you need an index. So if you've used a traditionally organized Roget's Thesaurus, you usually start in the back with the alphabetical index, and then that gives you a code, and then you turn to the book and you find the related words. But I love these systems, partly because they sometimes seem so strange to us. When you see things like the section for mathematics, including fortification, that's in, as in building military fortresses, and music, all lumped together as math. And you think, what mental universe did these people live in? And I'm not saying that to dismiss it. I'm really asking. It would be fascinating to, I mean, I think in our shared universe, we'd say music should go in among the arts. Mm-hmm. But in other cultures, they've decided music is a mathematical technology. Hmm. And I love looking through these old systems. They're often deliciously crazy.
We have a tweet from David who's hoping that you will talk about the Liddell Scott Greek English Lexicon.
Yeah, that is to this day the great dictionary of ancient Greek. It came out in the middle of the 19th century by two scholars, and he actually pronounced it Liddell, but most people now say Liddell, partly because this dictionary survived. Well, it exists in three forms. There is the abridged one, which is often used by students of ancient Greek. Then there is the one that's unabridged but doesn't have all the quotations. And then there is the big unabridged with all the quotations, Liddell and Scott, and they're nicknamed the Little Liddell, the Middle Liddell, and the Great Scott. Liddell is known to history for that reason, but also because his daughter was named Alice. And Alice hung out in Oxford with her father, where she met a young man. When she was still very young, she met a young man named Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, who's better known to us as Lewis Carroll. So the editor, one of the two editors of this great Greek dictionary, was the father of Alice in Wonderland. But the two of them worked together on a dictionary. They actually stole a great deal of it from a German source, And they acknowledged that stealing for the first few editions, but eventually erased the credit to him in later ones. But for a century and a half, that is the standard place to go to learn about ancient Greek. And there's a team working to replace it now. It's a Spanish group of scholars, but they've been at this for 60-some years, and I think they're still somewhere in the letter alpha at the very beginning of the alphabet. So perhaps our great-grandchildren will live to see it successfully completed.
Jumping back in time a little bit, you had scholars like Theophrastus and Pliny the Elder recording their observations of the natural world. And Pliny was really interesting because in a very modern way, he was trying to test his hypotheses. For example, he went out on a limb in a first century sort of way by asserting that rainbows were not miracles and they weren't necessarily signs from God.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by ancient, what we would call scientific dictionaries or scientific encyclopedias. The whole category of science is a fairly modern invention. He wouldn't have thought of himself as working on science, but these are fascinating places where we see people trying to survey everything that's known about the natural world and put it in some useful form. Theophrastus did a book on plants, which is still admired for some of the conceptual breakthroughs it made. Pliny was a remarkable one. He was so devoted to his scholarship and his research. First of all, he would always have a slave, a servant of some sort. Ancient Rome would have slaves read to him pretty much whenever he was awake. Hmm. So if he was in the bath, someone was next to him reading. If he was walking along the street, a servant was walking next to him reading to him. So he spent every minute acquiring new knowledge through texts. And he would also go out and test many of these things himself. He came to a sad end testing some of his ideas when he was leading a military expedition in the south of the Italian peninsula in AD 79 when there was a big explosion in the town of Pompeii. And his first thought was, this is fascinating. I need to know about this for my reference book. So he sailed straight toward an exploding volcano. And he was buried in the ashes, and he died there. But a diligent collector of reference books to the very end.
Russell in Frisco writes to ask about St. Isidore of Seville, who you tell us has been called the last wise man of the ancient world.
Yeah. We typically think of antiquity, which is mostly to say ancient Greece and ancient Rome, coming to an end with the fall of Rome or somewhere around there. And that's when we say the Middle Ages began. And we tend to treat the Middle Ages pretty badly. They're sometimes called the Dark Ages. They're supposed to be centuries of darkness and ignorance and superstition and so on. Isidore of Seville was an early Christian encyclopedist, but many people see him as the last representative of that ancient spirit of trying to know the whole world and not merely some Christian doctrine. So he did a fascinating dictionary, which we often call the Etymologies. He believed that the etymology of words, the sources of words, where our words came from, would give us insight into their true nature. So he collected this gigantic encyclopedia that's filled with strange plays on words and mystic puns. I like to say it's a poet's encyclopedia. He looks at the roots of the words and they tell him meaning of various things. I love the fact, I don't think this has been officially acted on yet, but Isidore of Seville has been proposed as the patron saint of the internet.
Huh. That would be wonderful if people could stop arguing. I'm sure that once one patron saint of the internet is proposed, the internet will will shoot that down and come up with 1,000 other ideas.
Fair enough, yes.
Let's go to the phones. We have Frank on the line in Duncanville. Hi, Frank.
Hello, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Very interesting show you're having today. My question originally, I had you guys pretty much answered when I went on the break, so let me break it up like this. where did the word antediluvian arrive from, and what exactly does it mean when it says an antediluvian world?
Yeah. Antediluvian, that's A-N-T-E, which looks a lot like anti, but it's a different root. Ante means before, diluvian means the flood. So antediluvian literally means before the flood, and since the flood is usually the flood in Noah, the word is sometimes used for unimaginably ancient or going back to the very beginning. It's a lovely word that invokes a whole world before everything came crashing down.
Speaking of word definitions, did ancient scholars mean the same thing we mean by the word encyclopedia?
Encyclopedia is one of the great mysteries because it looks an awful lot like an ancient Greek word. It's made up of ancient Greek roots, and people started using it in the Renaissance as a Greek word. But as far as we can make out, the Greeks never used it. And in fact, the few times we see the roots of that word put close together, there's en, which means in. The cyclo is from Greek kyklos, which is the word for circle. Think of cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And pedia is education. It comes from the word pais, which means child. But pedia is for education. So we've got in-circle education or in-circle learning. People thought it meant something like the circle of knowledge. So it became a term associated with encompassing all learning in one great circle. Actually, scholars now think when they see en kyklos and paideia close together in ancient Greek, it means something like a rounded education touching on different things. But there wasn't a book called an encyclopedia until the 1500s. There were books like encyclopedias before that, but no one thought to call it an encyclopedia until the Renaissance.
Jack Lynch is with us. He's professor of English at Rutgers University, and we're discussing his new book, You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rutgers University English professor Jack Lynch, author of You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jack, I was not expecting to find the Guinness Book of World Records here, but why not?
Why not?
How did an Irish brewery publish what would come to be like every elementary school student's favorite reference book ever?
It's a delightful reference book, but no one's quite sure what it's a reference book of, what kind of information it contains. But I remember an awful lot of my childhood devoted to the Guinness Book. The Guinness Book started when some people from the Guinness Brewery were out hunting, and they got in an argument over which was the fastest land bird or something to this effect. And they went back to the house of whichever one was hosting this get-together, and they pulled some books off the shelf, and they could not find which was the fastest bird. And someone said, you know, people in bars often have discussions like this. They want to know what is the first such and such, or the most, or the highest, or so, and so on. So they thought, hey, why don't we put together a booklet to give away to bars, so bars could have a place where they could settle bar bets. So people would, you know, say, I'll buy you a pint if you get this right. And they thought, well, if we can just put the name Guinness on it, it's essentially free advertising. So they got two brothers who were obsessive collectors of facts, and these two brothers worked for a surprisingly short time. They did the first edition of this book very quickly, and they collected things from thousands of sources and just put them all in one book. And they thought it would be a one-time giveaway to pubs, and the pubs would use it as advertising for Guinness Brewery. But it became fabulously successful. It sold out right away. They printed another one, and a few months later they did a new edition with some updates. And before they knew it, it was an annual tradition. Every year there would be a new one. Then, of course, they ran into the problem of once you come up with a reference book of superlatives, you get people who want to be in the reference book, who will do things to be the most or the highest or the what have you. Guinness, after a certain point, had to draw some strict lines and say, we will no longer accept records that are dangerous because people were hurting themselves or perhaps killing themselves in the hopes of entering this reference book. So they've now said no more of those.
I remember looking at the photographs, and there was that one of whoever had the longest fingernails in the world, and you just could not tear yourself away.
Burnt into my brain. Yes. I love that.
I suppose it's not dangerous, just maybe unsanitary.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I think they allow plenty of unsanitary things.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have James on the line in McKinney. Hey, James.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
First-time caller. I guess it was one of those days where I was just thinking about something, and then I was listening to the show. I said, hey, I think I'll give him a call. Anyway,
sure.
I appreciate your conversations. I was thinking back. I don't know why the thought came in my head, but I was thinking back in time and say like you were going from a country to a country and you needed some sort of reference or something like that. How would you know if somebody was, like if they gave you a translation book, how would you know? I guess you'd find out what you got there, but I mean, you know, people were.
Are you asking how you'd get an accurate book of translation from one language to the next?
Yeah, I was trying to get there, but yeah, you summed it up for me. Thank you.
All right, thank you. What do you know about that, Jack? Was it just sort of, you know, send away in the mail and hope you got something that you could use?
Well, dictionaries of all sorts, reference books of all sorts, largely trade on brand names now. So it's a safe bet if it's got Webster's International on the cover. You can assume that this was put together by some respect. Well, let's say Merriam-Webster. Webster is actually no longer a trademark, so anyone can put out a Webster's dictionary. But Merriam-Webster, one of the great dictionary makers in America. But yeah, there have been some really slipshod reference books released over the years, and there's a great one. English as She is Spoke is a guide to the English language written for Portuguese speakers by someone who didn't really speak a whole lot of English. And you don't necessarily feel good making fun of it, but it's hard not to make fun of it. It's been reissued just for people to flip through and browse and see how horribly unidiomatic some of these translations are. Yeah, there are some that are simply bad. The good news is that generally the market weeds them out over time. They don't go through many editions. They don't develop the good brand names.
Mickey in Addison wants to know if we have any idea what may have been lost with the destruction of the library at Alexandria.
We know almost nothing about the Library of Alexandria. We don't even know what happened to it. We don't even know if the legends say it was burnt, but legends say it was burnt in different centuries. And another possibility is it just got abandoned. It was a vast library by ancient standards. They had a lovely system. Alexandria in Egypt was a major port city. And they had a rule when ships pulled up in Alexandria, the authorities would take all the books that the ship carried, copy them, and then give the copies back to the ship, keeping the originals for themselves. So they built, by ancient standards, an unimaginably huge library. And they did important pioneering work in things like library catalogs, another kind of reference book. But we don't know anything about what books they had there, what has been lost that's never been seen again. We know it was a vast collection. We can sometimes figure out works that must have existed in ancient history and probably were in the Library of Alexandria that don't exist anymore. but we wish we knew more about that. In a way, one of the things we lost with the Library of Alexandria was knowing what was in the Library of Alexandria.
Do you think life as a scribe would have been fascinating or just incredibly tedious? Because on the one hand, you know, maybe scribes wouldn't have ever read what was before them unless they were working on that document. On the other hand, you're spending months on end copying one book into another format.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that the major tradition of scribes, at least in the European tradition, have been monks who have devoted their lives to silent contemplation. I think it would get pretty tedious pretty quickly. There's also, you as a scribe, you can almost only do damage to the work you're working on. you introduce right. errors, or even if you think you're fixing an error, you might be introducing a new one. So works that have been that survive in many copies are often riddled with errors. It was a very different culture, and I think from our point of view, it would be unimaginably tedious.
So have we lost anything by using this new storage technology that is the internet to house and access our information?
I'll start with the easy answer. Yes, because every change means we're losing something, just as we gain something with every change. The development of writing itself meant that we gained access to literature, but we lost access to traditionally memorized things and so on. What the internet age is doing for us, well, I won't be able to finish this convincingly because no one knows the answers to this, but in some ways, we now have access to more information than any human beings have ever had in history. In fact, any 12-year-old with a cheap laptop now has access to much more information than was ever in the Library of Alexandria. That's a wonderful thing. The downside, I think, to a lot of internet reference is the assumption that if it's not in the first few hits on Google and if it's not in Wikipedia, it doesn't exist. So we have this paradox where we have access to more sources of information than ever before. At the same time, a tiny number of sources answer almost all our questions. And the same way that farmers talk about monoculture, if you have a plot of land and only one kind of thing growing in it, it's subject to all sorts of diseases and so on. That's why a lot of farmers say, no, no, you should plant multiple strains of these things, multiple species. So if there's an infection, not everything is wiped out. I think that's probably a good idea. We should encourage a kind of lively and diverse ecosystem of reference books rather than the monoculture of just Wikipedia. Wikipedia is wonderful, mind you.
Do you think of Google or any search engine as in itself a work of reference?
That's a great question because the boundary line between reference source and database is breaking down. I started by saying a reference book is organized to let people find information in it. But that organization takes a lot of thinking, a lot of planning. And what we're seeing in the computer age is a great many sources designed to do the same kind of thing as references aren't organized at all in the same way a reference book is organized. Instead, they let users make queries. They let you ask something, and then they fetch the relevant bits out of the database. And that's a different kind of thing. Entries don't really exist except when they're summoned into being by one database query. So I don't think they're exactly the same thing. I think there are some differences there that do genuinely make a difference in how we should think about how we as a civilization collect and preserve information. But they're doing similar kinds of things.
Why, when we have access to more information than anyone had in the past, you know, in our little handheld devices, what do you think causes human beings to waste so much time calling up information that is not particularly valuable?
Yeah, well, sometimes we call up information that's not valuable because it confirms our biases, mm-hmm. because it's the information that we've always expected to find, and so on. But I do think that the technological change of pace means we now expect information right this moment. And there are times when I'm sitting at my computer and I will spend a disturbing amount of time poking around various websites trying to get an answer, and then finally realize if I simply straightened my legs and took a book off from the bookcase right above my computer, I would have a good authoritative answer from Oxford University Press scholars. But I've just now fallen into the same habit everyone else has of, hey, computer, deliver information to me right now.
Yeah, I found myself incredibly frustrated if, like, a dictionary website is running slowly, and I have dictionaries
yes.
right there.
Exactly. I mean, any bookish person is still probably surrounded by the things, but we don't often pull them off the shelves anymore, which is a pity.
A guy like you has to have a handful of favorite reference works in your personal collection. Do you mind telling us what you would grab from your office if the building caught fire?
I have a little mini chapter in my book about the reference books and how I've organized them in my own personal study. And I have one shelf right above the computer that I can reach without standing up. And that's where I've got the current Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary and so on. I've got the major English and American dictionaries. I've got basic fact books and so on. And as you get further and further away, they're the books I look at less often, the Norwegian Dictionary and the Encyclopedia of Heraldry. I am an absolute sucker for Samuel Johnson's dictionary. It's one of the very few I have read from cover to cover. I can spend the rest of my life splashing around in the Oxford English Dictionary. And I also love quirky reference books like Schott's Miscellany, which is a reference book, but God only knows what it's a reference book to. It's just a bunch of facts that Ben Schott found interesting and put into a book. That's how I'd spend my time. If the Library of Alexandria were burning down around me, I would pull those out and just amuse myself.
Was there a story, a work that you wanted to include in this book that you couldn't find enough information about?
My problem was finding far too much information. I originally told my publisher, this might be about 110,000 words. The book I delivered is 140,000 words, and that's about half of what I wrote. I spent a lot of time cutting things out, and it was painful, but it's already a very big book. I could easily have written 1,000 pages.
There comes volume two.
Oh, yeah. I don't see that happening, but they're all out there for other people to enjoy.
Jack Lynch is professor of English at Rutgers University and author of the new book, You Could Look It Up, The Reference Shelf from Ancient Babylon to Wikipedia. Jack, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones from Braylon Becton. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.